And 2 Kings chapter 18. And Tim, you didn't record any of that stuff beforehand, right? Excellent. Good job. He knows how to protect my persona. 2 Kings chapter 18. Excuse me. Just a quick recap of everything we have studied. The kingdom divides in 975 BC. It began, I could back up even a little bit farther. We can say the kingdom began in the 1100s with Saul. Saul reigned for 40 years from about, it was about 1155 that Saul began to reign, and he reigned for 40 years, and then David reigned for 40 years, and then Solomon reigned for 40 years. So it would be, yeah, that's right, well, 120, 1095. No, doing my math wrong here. Yeah, 1095 BC, the kingdom begins under Saul. He reigns for 40 years, David reigns for 40 years, Solomon reigns for 40 years, and then the kingdom splits. And we have the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom starting in 975 BC. We've been tracing the history of both of these kingdoms. And the history of the northern kingdom has been one of continual and repeated idolatry and violation of the terms of the covenant of God. The southern kingdom has been one of sporadic faithfulness. Sometimes they're faithful, sometimes they're not. They've had periods of extreme apostasy. They've had periods of revival. Rehoboam into Abijah, into Asa, and then into Jehoshaphat. While the northern kingdom went from Jeroboam, who set up the calf worship, his son Nadab took the throne, but then Nadab was killed by Baasha. And so we enter the second dynasty. Baasha ruled for 24 years. His son Elah rules for 2 years and is assassinated by a fellow named Tibni. And then Tibni and Omri go into a civil war for about 4 years or so before Omri takes over and settles on the throne, and he rules for a total of 12. Then we have his son Ahab, and Ahab's son Ahaziah, who dies from an accident, and Ahaziah's son Jehoram. And then Jehoram is assassinated by Jehu at the command of God. All the while, things are going on in the southern kingdom fairly continually with one dynasty. But we're into our third dynasty, or fourth, if you count this short-lived fellow Tibni up here. So we're in our fourth dynasty in the northern kingdom. We have that little fun problem down here with Athaliah, the queen, ruling on the southern kingdom. She's actually a son of Ahab, or a daughter of Ahab. And so she rules on the throne for a little while before they're able to restore the dynasty with Joash. And then things continue on there. In the north, we have Jehoahaz and then Jehoash. In the south, we have Amaziah, or Uzziah is his other name. And I'm sorry, Amaziah. I'm getting that mixed up. Azariah is his son, Uzziah. Then Jeroboam II. And during Jeroboam II's time and Uzziah's time, both of the kingdoms expand quite a bit their power base. They expand economically, militarily, and geographically, because there is a gap of expansive leadership in this big dog country called Assyria. There's a period where the Assyrians are not trying to expand, and that gives Judah and Israel an opportunity to strengthen themselves. We have a little bit of several changeovers again in the north, where Shalom kills Zechariah, and then Menahem kills Shalom, and then Pekahiah and Pekah rule, and then there's an interregnum where there is no king sitting on the northern kingdom, but actually Ahaz, the king of Judah, is called king of Israel in one instance, and so we think that the Assyrians, who have restored themselves to power by this point, come down and they appoint Ahaz king not only of Judah but also of Israel. That only lasts for a little while, and then the Assyrians appoint this fellow Hoshea, but he rebels. He stops paying tribute. The king of Assyria finally decides he's had enough of this upstart kingdom. He comes in, destroys Samaria, deports the people off into the far reaches of the Assyrian Empire. And so we are left with just the southern kingdom and not much of it. It has been reduced to a very small state because of the incursions of the Assyrians. And so that's where we pick up when Hezekiah takes the throne in 2 Kings chapter 18. How do you like that? Whirlwind, we just covered like 250 years of history in about 6 minutes. Are you dizzy? Yeah. Very. Mm-hmm. And you say, Pastor, it took you 4.5 years to cover all that. How come you couldn't have just done that before? Oh. We've been in this study for quite a long time. So 2 Kings 18, 1, in the third year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years when he began to reign, and he reigned for 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. So Hezekiah comes to the throne. Now, again, because we had to switch kingdoms, we had to back up a little bit in time. So Hezekiah takes the throne in the third year of Hoshea. So Hezekiah takes the throne before Hoshea and the northern kingdom are destroyed. This is probably right close to the time when Hoshea begins rebelling and ceasing to pay tribute to the Assyrian Empire. But it's not going to be long before the Assyrians come. So, Hezekiah takes the throne. How old is he when he takes the throne? 25. He's 25 years old. Now, I want us to go back just a little bit. Here's an interesting little tidbit. Go back to chapter 16, verse 1. We're going to look at the time when his dad takes the throne. How old, chapter 16, verse 1, in the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. So how old was dad, Ahaz, when he began to reign? 20. He was 20. And he reigned how long? 16 years. So how old was dad when he died? 36. He would have been about 36 years old. How old was Hezekiah when he took the throne? 25. Now do some math here. Hezekiah was 36 when he died, and Ahaz was 36 when he died, and Hezekiah was 25 when he took the throne. How old was Ahaz when Hezekiah was born? 11. 11 years old when he fathers his son. Interesting, isn't it? So that actually means that when Ahaz took the throne at how old? 20. How old was Hezekiah when Ahaz took the throne? He was already 9 years old. So Hezekiah is 9 years old at this point. And he's watching everything his dad does. What kind of king was Ahaz? He was a very bad king, right? What else do we know about Ahaz that he did as a bad king? You can review there in the first few verses of 2 Kings 16.
He trusted
Assyria. Right? He formed an alliance with Assyria. So when Hezekiah takes the throne, he probably inherits a peace treaty with Assyria. And he inherits Judah as a vassal state. But what else do we know about Ahaz? He did some remodeling. He closed the temple, didn't he? He shut it down completely. And that was after he installed a whole bunch of idols in the temple. But look at verse... where'd it go? Chapter 16, verse 5. He walked in the way of the kings of Israel. He even burned his sons as an offering, according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. So, imagine being Hezekiah watching this go on. So, probably was not at the beginning of the reign that Ahaz begins sacrificing his sons. Maybe toward the middle, or maybe further here toward the end, but Hezekiah escapes this somehow and begins watching dad throwing all of your brothers into the arms of that burning idol. What kind of an impact do you think that had on young Hezekiah? Probably wouldn't want to talk to his dad for a very long time. Yeah, that might make you hesitant to approach dad about anything, right? Mm-hmm. Happy he's older. Yep. Yeah, make you a little leery of spilling the milk, huh? Yes, yeah, they sacrifice the infants. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is probably why Hezekiah escapes this, because he's old enough already. So what do you think young Hezekiah is going to do with this kingdom? Is he going to follow in the ways of his father? No, he doesn't. In fact, Hezekiah is going to institute one of the most expansive reforms of the kingdom that Judah will ever see. Of course, according to the needs of the time, there needed to be some severe changes. Eldon.
I see here where his mother was the daughter of Zechariah. Is that the second wife of the prophet?
No, Zechariah the prophet prophesies quite a bit later. Than this, I think Zechariah, see if we can find him. There's Habakkuk, there's Daniel, Ezekiel. Zechariah is one of the later prophets, if I'm remembering right. There he is. He's way up here in the 520s. There was a priest named Zechariah, but it was quite a bit before Hezekiah, and so probably not the same guy. I did a little searching on that name to see if it would tell us anything, but I didn't find anything that would help us with how she was raised. But let's dig into Hezekiah's reign and see what he's going to accomplish here. So, chapter 18, verse 1, in the third year of Hosea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah, and he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that David his father had done. This is an interesting phrase because most of the kings of Israel, it says according to all that his father and names his actual dad had done. Why is it interesting that the writer connects Hezekiah back to his father David? Yeah, Hezekiah is going to be obedient unlike any of the kings of Israel have been to this point, other than David. So the writer is really connecting Hezekiah's character with the character of David more so than with his own fathers, and especially because Ahaz was a wicked man. But it doesn't even connect it with his father Uzziah or Jotham, who were both righteous men. When it mentions Jotham and Uzziah, it says that they did right according to their father Jotham, or according to their father Uzziah, or Amaziah. It doesn't connect them back to David, but Hezekiah gets connected all the way back to David. So that gives us a little clue as to what kind of faithfulness Hezekiah is going to demonstrate for us. He removed the high places and broke down the pillars and cut down the Asherah, and he broke in pieces the bronze serpent. This one's interesting, that Moses had made. For until those days, the people of Israel had made offerings to it, and it was called Nehushtan. Okay, think back to this bronze serpent. Where did he come from?
Moses.
From Moses, yep. Why did Moses make a bronze serpent? Mm-hmm. Tim? Right, so the camp was invaded by poisonous snakes. And why did a bronze serpent have anything to do with that? Were they worshiping the god of the bronze or of the serpents?
I don't think of that
point. Nope. Okay. Right. So the command was, look at the statue. If you're bitten by a snake, just look at the statue and you'll be healed. It's a great example of salvation by faith, right? You just look at Christ. Just trust him and you're cured. You're saved from your sin. Abby?
Why would God send snakes into their camp, but then they just have to look at the thing and they're healed, but then they're probably get bitten by another snake?
Well, it's possible, but the snakes were a discipline on the people of Israel because they were rebelling against God at the time. So he sent the snakes in as a discipline, but if they would trust God, they could just look at the bronze serpent and they would be healed, right? Just like Christ cleanses us of our sin. And we can be believers and still sin, but Christ is still the one that does it. And so it was this great demonstration of salvation by faith. But who commanded the making of the bronze serpent? God did. Oh, wait a second, Hezekiah. So now you're going to destroy this thing that God told Israel to make? They don't need it anymore? Ooh, interesting point. Abby? They're worshiping it as an idol. Yeah, isn't that crazy? How often do we start to worship something that God gave us? What kind of things do we worship that God gave us? Money? Tim? The symbol of the cross? Ooh! Isn't that interesting? Do some people worship the cross? Sure do. You know, we wear it as jewelry, and sometimes people think just wearing it is what's going to protect them from flat tires on their car, or breakdowns, or bad juju at work. So what's Hezekiah's answer to this idolatry problem? He is on such a crusade to eliminate idols from Jerusalem that he's even willing to eliminate something that was God-ordained but had become an idol. This is a huge step. Because imagine how the people of Israel reacted to this. Because here you've got this thing that God told them to establish. Do we ever get traditions that become idols? How hard is it to get rid of them? Because let's go ahead, Gary. It's not very easy, is it? Because people get attached to them. And when you start saying, we got to get rid of it, they look back to the initial founding of it and start saying, well, this is why we put this thing in place. And you can say, yeah, that's why it was put in place, but that's not what it is now. And it becomes very difficult to get rid of those things. But here's what Hezekiah is doing. He's eliminating this. This thing's probably been around for, trying to do some quick math, if we are in the 700s, it's been around for about 800 years. How many traditions do we have going back 800 years? Communion? Is it possible that communion could become an idol? Exactly right. Yeah, if you think that actually eating that somehow contributes grace because of the stuff, you're worshiping an idol. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Through the pronouncement of the Eucharist, they think it actually becomes that body and blood. And they literally do say they worship the body and blood of Christ. Very, very clear that that has become an idol. So, do you do away with communion? Tim, we're kind of buzzing. Is that because you were turned up loud? Coming from my... Yeah. Turn me down a little. Oh, it's still there. It's not too bad, though. Did it? Ah. There we go. We must have a short in the wire. Okay. Is it still picking me up? Okay. So, would you get rid of communion? No? Why not? Let's let Gary defend his position first, Elton, then we'll come to you. That's true. Mm-hmm. Okay. Shouldn't be, right? So as long as you can use it without worshiping it, go ahead and keep using it. Mm-hmm. So why do you think that Hezekiah doesn't, or why does he doesn't just reform this thing? Instead, he destroys it. Oh, there's a big difference too, right? Are we commanded to do communion? Yes, we are. And that's a practice that's supposed to continue how long?
Until
Christ comes back, right? He told us when he instituted communion, I won't drink this cup or eat this bread with you until I drink it anew in my Father's kingdom. So as often as you do this, do it in remembrance of me. So we are commanded to be doing the communion ceremony in remembrance of him until he comes back. That's part of what we're supposed to be doing. So wouldn't be right for us to just quit doing it, even if we came to a point where we realized, wait a second, we're worshiping this thing. We would need to reform it, which is what the reformers did. They recognized the problem that was going on in the Eucharist, and this is an area where we would part with Martin Luther, because he wanted to cling to the actual changing of it into the body and blood. And guys like Ulrich Zwingli came along and said, no, it's just a symbol. And Martin Luther said, no, it's got to be the body and the blood. And so Ulrich Zwingli took that aspect of theology a little better than Martin Luther did. So, you know, we're not, we like a lot of what Martin Luther says, but we don't take everything he says. I heard a great, great challenge by one of my old professors at ABC, Dr. Joe Pinter. And he said, be careful of identifying yourself with any theologian other than the biblical text. Because we can claim and say, well, I follow this guy or I follow that guy, and that might be good, but guess what? All people are fallible. The Bible is infallible. But I might get it wrong. And so we've got to be careful on that. So we can look up to Martin Luther and we can say, hey, he got a lot of stuff right, but he did get a few things wrong. And so we look to the biblical text. So we would have to continue communion because it's commanded of us. So we would have to reform the process. But did Hezekiah have any command to continue using that golden or that bronze serpent? No, there wasn't even a need for it, was there? Because were there fiery snakes sent as a discipline from God? Nope. And so he was well within his rights as king to say, we got to destroy this thing because it has become an idol. There's no more use for it. There's no more function for it. And it's got to go. Eldon, you were going to say something. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. But there are times when it is better to say, you know what, we got to cut this thing out completely because it's become such a problem. And we might be able to work on reforming the idea behind it, but until we do, let's just get rid of it because it's such a huge distraction. And that's where Hezekiah comes to with this Nehushtan. This fiery serpent. So he just completely destroys it. He gets rid of it. He goes through this sweep of Jerusalem and Judea to get rid of the idols. Now, what's interesting about this is it's not just him. So I want to turn to 2 Chronicles. Keep your place there in 2 Kings, because 2 Chronicles actually gives us a very detailed history of what Hezekiah does. And 2 Kings is going to actually jump in verse 9 to the fourth year of Hezekiah. But a lot of things happen in the first few years. So I'm just going to read down through this. Follow along as we read. I'm in 2 Chronicles chapter 29. 2 Chronicles chapter 29. We're going to start in verse 3. We've already read verses 1 and 2. Back in Kings, it's the same thing. So 2 Chronicles 29:3, in the first year of his reign, in the first month. So this is one of the first thing he does. Now, we've talked about the ascension year of the kings. The first year of Hezekiah's reign is going to be the beginning of the calendar year where he's the sole king. He was actually on the throne partly in the year prior to that, but because that's the year Ahaz died, that year gets counted to Ahaz. So let's say that Ahaz died in September. Hezekiah took the throne in September, and he rules until the following April, which is the first of the year. And the Passover month was their first month. So that would have been in the spring of the year. That year then gets counted as his first year and his first month. So he has been ruling for a few months, but this is the first point when it's actually his rule, counted as his rule. So this is one of the very first decisions that he's making as the new king. First year of his reign, first month, he opened the doors of the house of the Lord and repaired them. Why were they shut? Hezekiah didn't shut it down. Ahaz, yeah, dad shut it down. So from day one of his official rule, Hezekiah is parting ways with his father, and in his policy decisions is acknowledging that everything his dad did is wrong. Okay? Tough stand to make, isn't it? He opened the doors of the house of the Lord and repaired them. Verse 4, he brought in the priests and the Levites and assembled them in the square on the east and said to them, hear me, Levites. Now, consecrate yourselves and consecrate the house of the Lord, the God of your fathers, and carry out the filth from the holy place. What filth?
Idols.
Right. All of the idols and the altars to the false gods that had been placed there. He calls them filth, and he says, get them out of here. Verse 6, for our fathers have been unfaithful and have done what was evil in the sight of the Lord our God. They have forsaken him and have turned away their faces from the habitation of the Lord and turned their backs. They also shut the doors of the vestibule and put out the lamps and have not burned incense or offered burnt offerings in the holy place to the God of Israel. So Hezekiah is acknowledging that worship in the temple has completely shut down. The fire that was on the altar has gone out. The offering of incense, which was supposed to be made every day, has not happened. The table of the showbread is empty. This temple has completely shut down, come to a standstill. But he says, we're going to get it going again. Verse 8, therefore, because we've done this, therefore, the wrath of the Lord came on Judah and Jerusalem, and he has made them an object of horror, of astonishment, and of hissing, as you see with your own eyes. For behold, our fathers have fallen by the sword, and our sons and our daughters and our wives are in captivity for this. Now, this is not the captivity to Babylon. It's not even the captivity to Assyria, because that hasn't happened yet. This is talking about some of the incursions of the Assyrians that happened under the reign of Pekah, who attacked Ahaz. Remember when he came down and took some captives because Rezin, the king of Syria, also took captives from Judah. So Hezekiah is saying, look, the reason we're suffering all these horrible things is because we've abandoned the covenant of God. Now, verse 10. It is in my heart to make a covenant with the Lord, the God of Israel, in order that his fierce anger may turn away from us. My sons, do not now be negligent, for the Lord has chosen you to stand in his presence, to minister to him, and to be his ministers, and to make offerings to him. So Hezekiah is telling the Levites, we are remaking the covenant. Not like we're changing it, but we are reinstituting the Mosaic covenant. We're making a new agreement with God that this generation will do what God says, whereas the last generation didn't. Verse 12, then the Levites arose, Mahath, the son of Amasai, and Joel, the son of Azariah, one of the sons of the Kohathites, the sons of Merari, Kish, the son of Abdi, and Azariah, the son of Jehalalel, and of the Gershonites, Joah, the son of Zimah, and Eden, the son of Joah, and of the sons of Elisaphan, Shimri, and Jeul, and the sons of Asaph, Zechariah, and Mattaniah, and the sons of Heman, Jehul, and Shimei, and of the sons of Jeduthun, Shimei, and Uziel. They gathered their brothers and consecrated themselves and went in as the king had commanded by the words of the Lord to clean the house of the Lord. So they're going to cleanse the temple according to the Mosaic requirement, which means sacrifice, splattering blood, washing everything with water, getting the idols out, and re-sanctifying the entire temple premises. The priests went into the inner part of the house of the Lord to cleanse it, and they brought out all the uncleanness that they found in the temple of the Lord into the court of the house of the Lord. And the Levites took it and carried it out to the brook Kidron. They began to consecrate on the first day of the first month. So this is day one of Hezekiah's rule in this new calendar year. He says, get it sanctified. And they begin, day one. They began to consecrate on the first day of the first month, and on the eighth day of the month they came to the vestibule of the Lord, and then for 8 days they consecrated the house of the Lord. And on the 16th day of the first month, they finished. It took them 16 days to clean out the temple. How long does a spring cleaning take? A day if we're lucky? No, it takes quite a long time, doesn't it? But 16 days, these groups of Levites and the priests are working at cleansing the temple. It must have been a filthy place. Then they went in to Hezekiah the king and said, "We have cleansed all the house of the Lord, the altar of the burnt offering and its utensils, and the table for the showbread and all its utensils. All the utensils that King Ahaz discarded in his reign when he was faithless, we have made ready and consecrated, and behold, they are before the altar of the Lord." Then Hezekiah the king rose early, gathered the officials of the city, went up to the house of the Lord, and they brought 7 bulls, 7 rams, 7 lambs, 7 male goats for a sin offering for the kingdom and for the sanctuary and for Judah. And he commanded the priests, the sons of Aaron, to offer them on the altar of the Lord. So they slaughtered the bulls, and the priests received the blood and threw it against the altar. And they slaughtered the rams, and their blood was thrown against the altar. And they slaughtered the lambs, and their blood was thrown against the altar. What's the cost of rebellion? Blood, life, sacrifice. We rebel against the Lord God and against his commands. There is a demand of death for it. And every time they had to slit the throat of these animals and collect its blood, it was this new reminder that this is what our rebellion cost us. In order to restore the relationship, there has to be blood, there has to be death. Because the penalty of sin is death. Then the goats for the sin offering were brought to the king and the assembly, and they laid their hands on them, and the priests slaughtered them and made a sin offering with their blood on the altar to make atonement for all Israel. For the king commanded that the burnt offering and the sin offering should be made for all Israel. And he stationed the Levites in the house of the Lord with cymbals, harps, and lyres, according to the commandment of David and of Gad the king's seer and of Nathan the prophet, for the commandment was from the Lord through his prophets. Now pause right there. Why does Hezekiah restore the musical aspect of worship in the temple? It was commanded by who? By God through David and Gad and Nathan. So why is this interesting? Because remember, the Samaritans are going to deny that anything other than the Mosaic Pentateuch is part of the Word of God. But it was clear even at this point. Now, we are about 300 years after David, but it was clear even to them that David was a prophet and that he and Gad and Nathan were speaking the word of the Lord when they organized all of the Levites into a musical orchestra to worship. The Psalms, inspired. And so it's by this point that Israel recognizes that God was working through David to inspire a worshipful section of the Old Testament for music. Okay? Levites stood with the instruments. This is verse 26 of David, and the priests with the trumpets. And Hezekiah commanded that the burnt offering be offered on the altar. And when the burnt offering began, the song to the Lord began also. And the trumpets, accompanied by the instruments of David, king of Israel. The whole assembly worshipped, and the singers sang, and the trumpeters sounded. All this continued until the burnt offering was finished. And when the offering was finished, the king and all who were present with him bowed themselves and worshipped. And Hezekiah the king and the officials commanded the Levites to sing praises to the Lord with the words of David and of Asaph the seer. What's that? What are the words of David and of Asaph? The Psalms, what we're studying Wednesday night. Yeah. So they're using the Psalms as their hymn book. They sang praises with gladness and they bowed down and worshipped. And then Hezekiah said, "You have now consecrated yourselves to the Lord. Come near, bring sacrifices and thank offerings to the house of the Lord." And the assembly brought sacrifices and thank offerings. And all who were of a willing heart brought burnt offerings. The number of the burnt offerings that the assembly brought was 70 bulls, 100 rams, 200 lambs. All these were for a burnt offering to the Lord. And the consecrated offerings were 600 bulls and 3,000 sheep. Now the burnt offerings would have been killed and offered right then. The consecrated offerings were dedicated to the use of the temple for the daily sacrifices. But the priests were too few and could not flay all the burnt offerings. So until other priests had consecrated themselves, their brothers the Levites helped them until the work was finished, for the Levites were more upright in heart than the priests in consecrating themselves. So Hezekiah calls for this reinstitution of temple worship, but the priests didn't get into it too wholeheartedly. The Levites did. But there still were not enough Levites and priests in the southern kingdom to handle this volume of sacrifice. And so they had to help. Besides the great number of burnt offerings, there was the fat of the peace offerings, and there were the drink offerings for the burnt offerings. Thus the service of the house of the Lord was restored, and Hezekiah and all the people rejoiced because God had provided for the people, for the thing came about suddenly. So this reform starts with this huge revival service where they reconsecrate the temple and everybody begins bringing in their thank offerings and freewill offerings to supply the temple because it hasn't been running for a while. And this is the beginning of Hezekiah's reign. This is the beginning of his reform. Now, what month is it? Yeah, it's the first month. So it would be our March, maybe April. Depends on how the calendar went that year. Remember, the Hebrews used a calendar of 12 months of 30 days each. And every second, seventh, ninth, and 11th year, I think, they threw in an extra month. So those years had 13 months. But they had 30-day months. So it wanders around a little bit according to our calendar. That's why Passover was so late this year. But if you'll notice, Passover was late, and what's going on with spring? It's kind of holding on a little bit, isn't it? Spring's coming late. We should be planting tomatoes this week, the middle of May, but I don't think I'm going to plant mine just yet. You putting yours in this week, Gary? Yeah, it's still good weather for planting cabbage. It's nice and cool. So this is the beginning of Hezekiah's reform. We've run out of time here, but we'll continue into looking at his reform. What's supposed to happen according to the Mosaic Covenant in the first month every year? Which feast? Not Tabernacles. That's the same as the Tabernacles, boost. Yep. The Passover. On what day of the month? Ooh, now I'm stretching your brain, right? Nope. Passover was supposed to happen on the 14th day of the month. Because that's the day God led them out of Egypt. Incidentally, 14th day of the month would be what phase of the moon? It'd be a full moon. Okay. So, Passover always happens on a full moon. And so, Passover is supposed to happen the 14th day of the month, but we're on the 16th day of the month, and they haven't had Passover yet. So, they're going to celebrate it on the second month. And that's what we'll get into next week. Any questions?